Good morning, everyone. It feels like people are really settling in to this session. I'm Ugetsu, and I was settling in until it dawned on me I had to give this talk, and then that is kind of unsettling, but it's what's in my bowl, and I'm thankful to have it. I come every year to Shuso session. I always like to come because I feel it recharges my batteries before the fall, a time of bustling activity. And although I've been coming since the 1990s, I might have been here at the first time we had a retreat here. It's the first time I've ever been anywhere near the Chidin. And this is probably a wise thing because I can be a little bit rough. So this year I'm assistant to our Chidin Ocean. And I like doing new positions. It's challenging, but I always learn something new from it. And doing each position, basically, it's the same thing. You need to pay attention. If you're paying attention, if you're in the moment, if you're open to what's in your bowl, you're in good shape. So the Chidin maintains and adorns the altars. And one of the most challenging tasks is to take care of the black box, the haku. And this is that black box where the officiant sprinkles the powdered incense on a piece of burning charcoal. And so it's challenging maintaining this box because every flake of incense that doesn't go in the ash has to be picked out with a pair of tweezers. It's painstaking work, and it takes a long time. And it's really a challenging practice. But our Chidin said something to me that was helpful. He said, you can always tell whether or not the person who made the offering has ever been Chidin before. Yeah, he said, because if you have been Chidin, almost all of the ash is right on top of the charcoal. You know, if you haven't, it's scattered all over the place. And, you know, it's too bad, buddy. That's your practice for Chidin. And I get a kick out of it because it's acknowledging the labor that is necessary to make all of this happen. And when we are able to, when we know because we've had the position, we're able to make our offering in a different way with another dimension to it. And in this way, session is a great training vehicle. I think what I love most about session is the way we look after each other. That to me is session. That's why I come every year. We chant, and we're going to do this pretty soon. First 72 laborers brought us this food. We should know how it comes to us. Our tenzos have been braving the heat in this heat and humidity to bring us 3 meals and snacks each day. Our servers have continuously been getting up and down off the floor for 3 meals a day. Recognizing this, I think, adds something, a spice to our bowl, something that we'd be missing if we just paid attention to ourselves. There was a wonderful set of talks given at Dai Session, and if you haven't tuned into them, they're on the website. One of them, given by Shinryu Sensei, talked a lot about Pai Chang, who is one of our ancestors. And he's credited with giving us the container, with giving us the monastic form that we follow, with giving us the materials of Sesshin. And he gave us work practice. So he told this famous story about Pai Chang, who was in his 90s, and he was still going out into the field. And, you know, the younger monks were saying, look, you don't have to do this. Why don't you go inside, stay cool? And he just said, no work, no rice. Or another translation, a day without work is a day without rice. Having had a father who grew up on a peasant farm, his family, they were all peasants, I'm really familiar with this attitude. The Italians have a saying for it. Chi non lavora non mangia. He who doesn't work doesn't eat. Okay. And my father actually said this to me shortly after he retired. He was really depressed, and he said he didn't feel like he was earning his daily bread anymore. But my mother wisely stepped in at this point and taught him how to vacuum. And he ultimately learned how to appreciate a good nap, and that exercise was good work for keeping his body fit and staying healthy. Yesterday, I was struck, as people keep on going back to it, so you hit the right note, Sensei Ryotan, in talking about the importance of keeping our bowls open to whatever may land. The extraordinary, the ordinary, the pleasing, the troubling, this is the work, the great task of Sesshin. And it does seem much more clear in this controlled environment. Yet even when the water is clear, we manage to murk it up. Yeah. And the challenge is, they'll multiply when we get home and we get back to our complex lives. It's going to get harder. We know this. Those of us who have been coming year after year know the emptiness of setting up a session. The form will come, the practice will come, but over time, this attention can dissipate. But that's not really what I'm going to talk about today. What I'm going to talk about today is what happens when we're thrust into a situation beyond our comprehension. A calamity. What happens when you are in a calamity? An event causing sudden damage, death, misfortune, pain. It's all around you. How do you react then? I think the practice at that point in time is truly the thundercloud, truly the sky opening. You can remain open at that moment. Chinryu told the story of Pai Chang that, for me, showed his deep compassion for his students. One day he called his monks into the Buddha hall and then charged after them with his staff. And they all ran for the exit. And just before they're about to leave, he shouts, "Oh, monks, what is it?" Now, if you can, it's a story, but imagine, if you will, we're in the Buddha hall, and Roshi picks up that long stick that she's going to have during Shuso Sesshin, and she starts running at us with really, really pissed. The shock, you know, everybody knows, it would be really weird. You know, we'd be thinking, oh my God, what's wrong with her? I've lost my teacher. But then just as we're about to leave, "Hey you, what is it?" Maybe we catch our breath, and for a moment we can glimpse our fear. I think that's the hardest thing in the bowl, is fear. Roshi, you scared the crap out of us. Sometimes we need a rude intervention to really question, what is it? To really look carefully at our daily lives. And sometimes our daily lives are a calamity. And that calamity can be just what helps us see differently. In the 1980s, I remember watching my friends die of a disease that didn't even have a name at first. It was devastatingly horrible. Young men looked like walking skeletons. They were covered in brown lesions. When it became known as AIDS, there was fear and panic and terrible discrimination because of it. In the finest hospitals in this country, trays were left outside of patients' rooms because the staff didn't want to go in. They were afraid. It's hard to imagine, but it happened. And people were dying so quickly that you didn't know how to take it. It seemed surreal, like a nightmare. One day, my mentor, Joey, who had hired me at Gay Men's Health Crisis, told me he had KS. And less than a year later, I was crying at his funeral. And this happened over and over again. But it was hardest for the people with AIDS. Imagine that landing in your bowl in the early 1980s. A horrible, disfiguring plague lands in your bowl. One without a cure. One that you will be hated and reviled for. You will suffer and you will die. What do you do? I mean, the fear of that, of those days, the fear was devastating. And what it did is it drove everybody underground. People were trying to hide it. And obituaries didn't mention AIDS. They didn't talk about people dying of AIDS, or they wouldn't mention the deceased's significant other if they were gay. But even in this darkest of time, there were a few people who came out as having AIDS and who designated themselves as ones who were going to be courageous in the face of what landed in their bowl. Bobby Campbell, Michael Callan, and David Summers were among the first. In 1981, they formed the People with AIDS Coalition, and it's part of the People with AIDS Self-Empowerment Movement. And I just want to share a little bit of the Denver principles with you, because I want to show the kind of work that had to go on in that bowl at that time and share the wisdom of these people who came up with these words. So here is an excerpt from a 1982 document called The Denver Principles. It all happened in a conference in Denver. We condemn attempts to label us as victims, a term that implies defeat. And we are only occasionally patients, a term that implies passivity, helplessness, and dependence upon the care of others. We are people with AIDS. Recommendations, they list a bunch of recommendations. I'll just share the first. Support us in our struggle against those who would fire us from our jobs, evict us from our homes, refuse to touch us or separate us from our loved ones, our community, or our peers, since available evidence does not support the view that AIDS can be spread by casual social contact. Don't scapegoat people with AIDS and blame us for the epidemic or generalize about our lifestyles. That was the beginning. by the mid-1980s, that movement had spread. Now people were living a little bit longer. There weren't effective treatments yet, but they had gotten the prevention down a little bit. And at this point, I remember hearing the wisdom of John Robles, an HIV positive addict in recovery. And this was a part of a videotape I made with Greg Bordowitz. It ends with John saying this: "You know what philosophy is? It's life. It's walking down the street. It's going to the park. It's going to a movie. It's laughing. It's crying. It's reaching out and hugging someone. That's what my philosophy is. For me, it's simple. Life, live it to the best and to the fullest. Enjoy it. And then you have to deal with whatever comes when it comes." It strikes me as such a Zen statement, you know. Talk about practicing with a fire on your head. You know, these guys are bodhisattvas. And the movement that they inspired was, it changed the world. It changed the world because in 1987, enough people had died that people started to get angry and they started to fight back and they formed a movement. And the movement was called ACT UP, but it could have just as well been called WAKE UP. Basically, it was WAKE UP! Fight back! Fight AIDS. Now, I bring this all up because to me it's a little bit of an illustration today in present terms when I talk about it, because talk about the extraordinary and the ordinary. And just that little tipping point when one falls into the other. About a year ago, I started co-curating a show called Every Day. All right? It's called Every Day. And it's all about AIDS. And it's all about, it's all of the work of people living with AIDS or people who have died. So we decided that rather than show big ticket art, Robert Mapplethorpe, David Wojnarowicz, the famous names of people, famous work and names in the art world, we would just show how AIDS changed everyday experience. And the work is astonishing. You know, one man decided to weave baskets out of his lover's t-shirts after he died. Beautiful baskets, just woven from his t-shirts. A woman, Chloe Zabilio, who was still alive, made this beautiful necklace out of her pills. Lovely necklace. And before he died of AIDS, Edward Hochschild made a cross filled with vials containing the ephemera of his everyday life. It's a stunning piece of art. And I have to say, it was out on the curb. His landlord was throwing it out because it was just left in his apartment. But all of this, it causes me to question, this is in my bowl, and I'm drawn to the question, what is it that compels us to express the pain or the joy in our lives? And I think a large part of it is this conversation, this larger conversation about life and death that we're having with the universe. And there's something in the human experience that can't help, like any one of those cicadas out there, can't help but chirp from its little corner of the earth, all right, and lend itself to a larger voice. And I wanted to share one more personal story. A month ago, I arrived in Nice, France, on Bastille Day. It was to be the first day of a vacation that I had been promising myself for years. And actually, my old friend Janet and I decided we were going to meet in Nice and then make our way down to northern Italy, where we have some friends. And Bastille Day is noted for the day when the French stormed the prison, the Bastille, and brought revolution. Nice is noted for its fireworks. They take place over the ocean, so we were all excited to go. And being a tourist, if we could see our lives as if we were tourists, we'd be very blessed. Because you see everything with fresh eyes. Nice was astoundingly beautiful. There are a lot of old people there. And later on I found out in the EU, a lot of older people go there to retire because tax-wise it's advantageous. There are a lot of headscarves there, a lot of Muslims in Nice. And a lot of Muslims were at Bastille Day celebrations because it's a secular holiday. And so it's popular. So there are people from all over the world watching these fireworks. And next to me, I was very touched by a father and a son who were watching the fireworks. They both had southern accents, so it was funny when they were calling out like the rest of us, Vive la France. And after the fireworks, we all went to the promenade and we were... strolling along, there were bands playing. It was generally a very festive atmosphere. And I looked out and I saw the moonlight on the sea and it was glistening. And you know, I had just got into Nice and I was like, you know, we've been here and I haven't even been down to the sea yet. Let's go down to the sea. So Janet and I walked down the stairs and we were walking along the sea. And all of a sudden there was this huge outcry, like hundreds of people groaning at once. And I looked over my shoulder, and right over there was that truck. It just passed and then stopped. And people started to panic in a truly frightening way. People were pushing and running, and they weren't pushing like people online, they were pushing like a drowning man, flailing. So I was really faced right then. What happens when you're in a calamity and you do not have any comprehension of what is going on here? And I could tell you the first reaction is animalistic fear. It's just pure and plain fear. This is a terrorist attack. There's a bunch of guys in that truck with AK-47s, and they're hunting people down. Run. Get somewhere safe. And it would only be for much of the night, neither Janet or I could find out what the heck had happened. It was only later on that the news started coming out. And the next day, we found out that 84 people were killed and many more injured by a very angry and deluded man driving a truck. And among the dead was the man and his son from Texas. So I left Nice just wondering, what could bring on such anger? You know, I think that's the question that just is roiling in me. How could it have been stopped sooner? Unanswerable. Unanswerable. But when I returned to Nice a week later, there was an amazing outpouring of expressions of grief all along the promenade and even in the park. Were flowers, teddy bears, posters, everything you can imagine was on that promenade where a week before I had seen bodies. I took out my iPhone and I started filming all of these little private and public memorials. And there was one that just seemed to me so quintessentially French. I took a photo of it and The poem was in French, so I didn't understand it. So I sent the poem to Kyosei, because I know she speaks French. And she translated it this way. Love and respect for each other are primordial. We belong to the same family, the same human race. Let no one divide us. I send you all my love from Scotland, land of the brave. This man from another place decided to send an expression of love and solidarity. And we live in these times. I mean, you watch the news and it's happening every day, and the 24-hour cycle amplifies it over again. New calamities that shock and bewilder us. And they make us want to retreat to where it's safe, to close off. We're on retreat, but that's not our work here. Our work is to open up and to prepare ourselves to work with what comes in our bowls. This is our practice. I leave you with one last story by the Buddha himself. To me, it's always been the one I return to. There's a man walking across the field when suddenly he looks over his shoulder and he sees that he's being chased by a tiger. So he runs and and the tiger chases him, and he gets to a cliff. And he sees that his only alternative is to grab this vine and climb down. And he's dangling there, and he's looking up. He sees this tiger glancing down, and he looks down. All of a sudden, he sees another tiger. And he realizes, oh, shit. And then, to top it off, there are two rats, one white and one black. And they start nibbling at that damn vine. And in the midst of all of this, he sees a strawberry, and he picks it, and he tastes it, and it's amazing. He ate what was in his bowl. Lucky guy, he was open to it. There's no completion to the story, and I appreciate it because we bear witness to his dilemma as our own. We live in a world with disease and terrorism. That's it. But in this moment, there is freedom. In the face of everyday life and calamity, we can remain present for one another. Thank you.